Hey everybody, today's episode is sponsored by Penzu, your personal journal in the cloud. Penzu is where millions of people keep their most private thoughts, all locked with a secret password. Go to penzu.com, that's spelled P-E-N-Z-U now, and sign up for a free account. For extra security and fun customizations, go to penzu.com/GoPro on your computer and use promo code Radical for $5 off your Pro or Pro Plus subscription. Once again, that's promo code Radical. Now let's get to the show.
This is The Radical Therapist, a space where we explore the intersections of collaborative therapy, philosophy, art, and science and technology in a post-Freud, post-psychology world.
Welcome to The Radical Therapist. This is your host, Chris Hoff. We are now at episode 17, and we have a special one for you today. So thanks for tuning in. I moved into my current office about a little over two years ago, the one I'm in now, where I do my private practice at, and actually is one of the offices for California Family Institute. And I was thinking about this recently because it was about, seriously, only about 3 or 4 months ago that I realized I had a bookshelf in my office with no books on it. And in my home office, I have a ton of books. So I decided I should probably bring a few books over to the office, ones that I thought were special and I might access kind of regularly in my role at the office over there. So the three books I'm going to get a little intimate with you. The three books that I grabbed to take over to my office were Maps of Narrative Practice by Michael White, and my favorite book from my master's program, Collaborative Therapy with Multi-Stressed Family by Bill Madsen, Wayne Madsen. And the third book that I grabbed was Conversation, Language, and Possibilities, A Postmodern Approach to Therapy, by Harlene Anderson, and which has been a very influential book on me as well for many, many reasons, and influenced a lot of people that were important to me. So those are the three books that I grabbed, and I guess I'm bringing up that story because our guest today is Harlene Anderson, really, and I'm really excited about that, a legend of family therapy, somebody that has been just has shaped a lot of what is going on now in the field, and was considered, I think, part of that third wave. I guess what is characterized often as that third wave when narrative and solution focus, you know, Michael White and David Epstein, Steve DeShazer and Sue Kimberg, and then Harlene Anderson and Harry Galushian, this third wave that really, really transformed psychotherapy and still continues to do so today. So I'm really, really excited about today's show because we have Harlene here. So let me tell you, before we get to her, let me tell you a little bit about Harlene. Harlene Anderson, PhD, is a founding member of the Houston Galveston Institute, the Taos Institute, and Access Success. She is recognized internationally as being at the leading edge of postmodern collaborative practices as a thinker, consultant, coach, and educator. She takes her tools, her insights, her curiosity, her engaging conversational style, her leadership skills, and her keen interest to help professionals turn theory into new and often surprising possibilities for their clients, students, and organizations. She embodies her own beliefs and learning as a lifelong process, inviting, encouraging, and challenging people to be inquisitive, creative, authentic, and open to the ever-present possibilities for newness in others and in themselves. Harlene has authored and co-authored numerous professional writings, including her book, my book, the one of my favorites, Conversation, Language, and Possibilities, A Postmodern Approach to Therapy. She is a member of the editorial review boards of several journals. She has presented at numerous national and international conferences and has consulted with a variety of organizations. Among her many awards are the prestigious 2000 Outstanding Contributions to Marriage and Family Therapy Award from the American Association for Marriage and Family Therapy, and the 1998 Lifetime Achievement Award from the Texas Association for Marriage and Family Therapy. So without further ado, let's chat with Harlene. Hi, Harleen. Welcome to the show.
My pleasure, Chris. Thanks for inviting me.
Absolutely. I'm really excited that I was able, or that you had some time to talk to us. You are one of those people, I should probably tell you, that has been very influential on my work and my career. And I read a lot about you. People that were influential to me were very influenced by you as well. And and I've read a lot of your work, so it's kind of a nice opportunity to actually be able to have a conversation with you. So thank you for taking the time to do that.
Again, my pleasure, and thank you for sharing your interest in my work.
Yeah.
I'm pleased to hear that, and look forward to your comments after our conversation today.
Sure. I guess I would like to, because I don't know a whole lot about your history, so I guess I was wondering. I know you're trained, or I'm assuming, I have an assumption that you're trained as a psychologist and then probably found your way into the family therapy world and then began to write and experiment a lot with kind of this postmodern practices. But I'm wondering if you could kind of maybe share with us a little bit about your history, how you came into the field and how you kind of began to explore these ideas.
Of course, I'm happy to. My background, as you said, is in psychology, and in the early 70s, I was working at the University of Texas Medical Branch in Galveston, and as soon as I hit the campus, I began hearing people talk about something called family therapy with a lot of enthusiasm and excitement. I had never heard of it in my graduate training, so I signed up for the training when it started in the fall. And I went to the very first session, and it was like I found something that I didn't know I was looking for. Mm. What I began to realize is that it invited me to reflect back on some experiences that I had had in working at a community mental health center in various aspects of that, including day hospital, inpatient, community work, et cetera. And it began to give me a language and a vocabulary for thinking about my experiences, again, ones that I hadn't even really reflected on. But once I began hearing about multiple realities and systems and the influence of context on behavior, et cetera, it just really caught my attention. So I was gung-ho and read everything that I could get my hands on, completed the training, and then very shortly joined as a faculty member in the psychiatry department in the training program, and as a supervisor. And I think one of the things that happened early on that was very influential was that by the luck of the draw, my first supervisor when I was in the training was Harry Galician. Mm. And then as a supervisor, he believed in an apprenticeship model of training. So I was able to sit in with him with his clients. So, and I guess the rest is history. I joined the family therapy training group, and then later in 1978, because of some changes in the psychiatry department, we decided to found the Galveston Family Institute as a postgraduate training institute not affiliated with the medical school, and it just took off, and now we're in Houston rather than Galveston for many reasons, and we're called the Houston-Galveston Institute.
Yeah, and so that was in 78.
That was in 78 that we founded the Institute. So we're in what, our coming upon our 38th year.
Yeah, exciting. And you have written that when you formed, you were sent clients that I guess other organizations would call treatment failures, but it was really influential in how you began to develop your way of working.
Absolutely. The medical school was a state facility, and so people in Texas were referred from all over the state. So Texas is very large. You can drive for 12 hours and not get to where you're going.
Yeah.
So people would come for long periods of time, and we were referred, again, those that were thought of as treatment failures, revolving door cases, resistant clients, clients for consultation for a second diagnosis and treatment plan. And when we formed the Galveston Family Institute, we sat back and reflected on what were the values, what were the important things in our work that had led us to be creative and innovative and somewhat irreverent, not only in family therapy, but to psychotherapy in general. And what we realized was that it was very important to always work with challenging clients, and therefore you were a challenged therapist. We also began to realize how important it is to always work in a training context, to have learners who push you with challenging questions and offer perspectives that perhaps you hadn't thought about when they're describing and explaining what they think they saw or heard in terms of the therapy. And then thirdly, we realized that we had always had our own faculty seminar where we would meet once a week, usually at Harry Golishan's house in his kitchen. And yeah, around the table, and his wife would serve wine and popcorn, and we would read. And we found ourselves reading a lot outside of the field of psychotherapy, because the language in psychotherapy in general and in family therapy was not there that helped us describe our experiences of what we were doing and, importantly, the client's experiences of the therapy. So that's just kind of a brief...
When did you begin to actually start calling it maybe a collaborative practice or a postmodern practice and begin to write about it in such a way?
I would say in the early 80s. And the history of where collaborative came from was that, for those of you who are listening who might be in a medical setting or might have been in a medical setting, that the word compliant patient, cooperative patient, is very much part of the everyday vocabulary.
Sure. Yeah.
And so we didn't want people to think that we were talking about compliance or cooperation in the sense of doing what the doctor or doing what the nurse wanted the patient to do. So we began thinking of another word and played with the word collaborative, and of course looked collaborative and cooperative both up in the dictionary, and they have, regardless of the dictionary you look them up in, they have very, very similar definitions, and both usually include the word with. So we decided, for lack of another word, we'd go with collaborative. Interestingly enough, the first time that Harry Golishan and I went to Norway, we were doing a workshop on what, I don't know if we were calling it collaborative therapy or collaborative language systems at that time. And as soon as we announced the title of the workshop and introduced ourselves, hands just popped up. And we said, oh my, what? And what we learned was that collaborative was a very pejorative term in Norway because it referred to the French word collaborateur, which meant cooperating with the enemy during World War II, which happened in Norway and perhaps some of the other Scandinavian countries. So from that day forward, and today, as a matter of fact, I was just in Mexico last week and telling the same story and inviting people that if you can think of a word or a way of saying what I mean by collaborative, I'm more than happy to entertain your suggestion.
Yeah, because I know now that in a lot of ways it's called dialogical practice or conversational practice or even open dialogue came out of that. Yeah.
Well, I think the Open Dialogue group were influenced to some extent by our early work.
Right.
Also, now I sometimes refer to the practice as a withness practice, and that was influenced by the social psychologist John Schotter and the family therapist Lynn Hoffman, which many of your listeners will be familiar with. And they both drew from Mikhail Bakhtin, the Russian philosopher, literary critic's work, and his talking about withness versus aboutness. And so that word really captures for me, I would say even more so, or expands my definition of collaborative. In other words, being fully present with the other, talking with them, thinking with them, acting with them, responding with them, rather than talking to, for, at, or about them.
Yeah, I like that. So you began to do writing, and I know you began to write about postmodern practice in a way that was not, you described it as not a single definition, but you use the term postmodern tapestry.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm wondering if we can maybe run through some of these, some of the pieces of the tapestry that you began to write about and kind of expand upon.
Well, I would say one of our first theoretical shifts came with an interest in language, beginning very early, influenced by the MRI group's use of language. And for me to be rather facetious, I'll say using language in a strategic manner.
Mm-hmm.
And the more we began to think in terms of language and using it in that way and learning the client's language, we began to search and happened to bump into Humberto Maturana and Francesco Varela, the Chilean biologist, interest in language. So that was very important in our work for a while. And then we just kept looking at language, and we ended up in the area of hermeneutics, which then led us to an interest in knowledge and the development of knowledge. Hermeneutics, one of the earliest questioning of the dualistic nature of knowledge and the separation of the observed and the observer.
Mm.
And the whole notion that understanding is always interpretive, that we're always participating in describing the people sitting in front of us and our interpretations. And so then we became very interested in social constructionism, a theory of knowledge, and Kenneth Gergen's work, and met John Schotter's writings through Ken's work. And then became very interested in the notion of dialogue. And dialogue, not in the sense of a particular structure or that you can have steps for dialogue or a recipe for dialogue, but dialogue in the sense of Bakhtin that I mentioned earlier.
Yes.
And so then it's like, how do you describe or how do you name the assumptions that inform your work? So I started using the term in some of my writings, postmodern tapestry. In other words, a weaving of these threads, a weaving of these narrative fragments. And then I began using the term postmodern umbrella. And I began to think like an umbrella turned upside down, and these things just kind of fall and collect in it. And that there were threads that ran through, or themes that ran through, or assumptions that ran through the theories and philosophies that I've mentioned. And so that's how I landed on postmodern, the term postmodern, which can be very off-putting for some people because some people misunderstand it as anything goes or relativism to the extreme.
Right. Now, some of the aspects, if you don't mind, I'll go through some of these and maybe you can kind of talk about how you approach them or conceptualize them. But some of these threads that are in that umbrella, I think we start with maintaining skepticism. This idea, I think you wrote, the invitation is simply to question any discourse's claims to truth, including postmodern which I liked, including postmodern discourse itself.
Absolutely.
And hopefully to minimize the risk that we carry our knowledge errors forward. I thought that was really nice. Can you say a little more about that?
Well, what postmodern does is it offers several invitations, and one is to always take a questioning, doubtful, skeptical, critical perspective regarding what I think of as inherited knowledge, whether we're talking about the world in general or whether we're talking about the psychotherapy or family therapy fields, that we're just kind of born into these graduate schools and the discourses that any one particularly adheres to or is immersed in, and that we often just kind of walk along and take all of this for granted, that this is the way it's done, this is the truth. My gosh, the author of the book must know what he or she's talking about. The person at the head of the classroom must be an expert.
Yes.
And so what it does is it invites us to be, to put it very simply, an informed consumer. That if you like something, you're drawn to it, you want to buy it, so to speak, to know what the value is for you, what it permits you to do, allows you to do, and most importantly, what it does not permit or allow you to do.
Now, and another piece is the idea of eluding generalization. I think that's very attached to that, this idea that you kind of question the taken for granted, or...
Right. It connects with the questioning of assumptions, that when you work from a set of assumptions, even the assumptions that I work from, they begin to create a template or a map, which then it's very tempting to place what you think you see and hear on that map, which tells you what is and what is not. In other words, it's very easy to generalize, to place people or problems into categories. And the risk of doing that is that you only tend to see or hear the familiar or read the familiar, and that you more likely then will miss the novelty, the nuances, or the uniqueness of any one person or group of people that you're working with, and the unique life circumstances or the situations of their life that, they bring with them.
Yeah.
So John Schotter talks about the risk of generalizations as, he calls it, a continuous rediscovery of sameness.
Yeah, and I'm thinking about my own practice sometimes, and using maps and trying to fit things into certain slots, and what can all be missed in that effort, right?
It's very easy to do in the first 18 seconds after we meet someone. It's very easy to begin categorizing them. So think, for example, if the first thing you think about a woman that comes in talking about her 10-year-old is, oh my gosh, this is an overprotective mother. The moment that you place that label on her and that description, it begins to narrow what you can learn and understand about her. It begins to narrow the way in which she may tell her story in the way that certainly you will hear it.
Absolutely. And then another aspect or a thread that you wrote about is knowledge as an interactive social process. That knowledge, I like that you wrote this piece, knowledge is not fundamental or definitive. It is not fixed or discovered. Instead, it is fluid and changeable. Can you say some more about that?
Yes, I would say that both about knowledge and about language, that, again, we're born into a world and we live in a world where it's mostly thought that knowledge is something out there to be discovered, like you go on an archaeological dig.
Yes. Yeah.
That knowledge is something that's created at the top of the pyramid and then passed down to those of us who are at the bottom of the pyramid. It's like you can take it from one person's head and put in another. And so postmodernism questions that and suggests that knowledge is something that we create together. It's something we do together. It's a communal activity or process. And that, as Maturana said, there's no such thing as instructive interaction. I can't put something into the head of the listeners. They're bringing their own unique histories, their own unique ideas and experiences. I'm sharing, I'm offering some of my experiences, some of my ideas that I think of as my prejudices or biases, and I use those words in a positive sense. In other words, things that I'm prejudiced toward or biased toward, not in a negative sense.
Sure.
And that I think of it as offering things that are just kind of like little clouds floating around out there. And the people who are listening, the people that I work with, are interacting with what I might say, a question I might ask, and they're creating something unique for themselves. They're having their own inner conversation, their own inner dialogue as we are talking, just like I am as I'm talking, and most likely you are as I'm talking.
Right. And I love that Maturana quote, that idea of no such thing as an instructive interaction.
I found that very influential in the way that I think, yes.
Yeah, and I've been holding on to that more and more as well. And you did mention that that's the same for language as well, and I know Bakhtin said, no utterance in general can be attributed to the speaker exclusively, that there's so much attached to our language or words or...
Right. And then, as Wittgenstein says, it's that language is not representational. It's not a picture of something. It doesn't mirror something. Mm. That we create the meanings of the words in our use of them.
So one question I think I get a lot of, from the feedback I get a lot of students and grad students that listen to the show. And I know you talk about knowledge and language as transforming or transformative. And sometimes I think people wonder, like, well, how can you do away with intervention? Like, how does change happen, right, in a conversation or something like that? And I really like, I was wondering if you could say more about how knowledge and language are relational and generative, and how things, because I think sometimes people kind of misunderstand this piece.
Okay, let me shift then a little bit to the practice and what I call a philosophical stance, because people often say, well, what are the techniques, what are the skills for creating a generative conversation or a generative relationship? And sometimes I'm just very facetious and straightforward, and I say, I don't think in terms of techniques and skills. I think in terms of assumptions that inform my work that I think of as action-guiding sensitivities drawn from John Schotter, or that phrase influenced by John Schotter. Yeah. And that I think of my work as informed by then what I call a philosophical stance. And if so, I think, okay, so if you try to put some of the assumptions we're talking about into practice, into action, to perform them, then what do you do? And I begin to realize that you begin to do some things rather naturally and spontaneously once your quote-unquote belief or value system begins to shift some. Mm. And so I began to think in terms of using metaphors with my students, my learners. And so one metaphor that I began using is host and guest, that when you meet someone, that as the professional, I always think of myself as both a host and a guest in their life. Mm. And they are likewise in my life in terms of our professional relationship. And so I think in terms of with my learners, I have them pair up and with each other and share experiences of when they've been a host and had guests they really enjoyed and would really like to invite back. And likewise, when they were a guest and they were in a host space and they felt the host enjoyed having them and most likely would welcome them back, would invite them back. So I do that as a way of helping the new learners, the students in this learning this particular perspective, begin to develop a different way of being with people in just this very, very small way of the host-guest metaphor. And so then they say, okay, well, I think I know what you mean. I think I can be a welcoming host. I think I can be a welcomed guest in my client's life. Now what? How do I engage someone in a conversational partnership, or what I call a mutual or shared inquiry, that is and has a transformative nature to it? And I said, well, then the next metaphor I'm going to use is one of a gift. That I think of each person who comes to see me as bringing a very precious gift. And that gift is what I call a story ball of their life, all the events, relationships, etc., up until the point that we meet. And I have some images that I use in my teaching of a story ball.
Yes.
And you may have read about this.
I have, some
of your students, yes. I talk about it as kind of shredded paper. And I say that what you want to do is, if you think in terms of a story ball and that's what they're presenting you, I don't want you to take it away from them. I just want you to reach out and gently touch it and gaze upon it, and to keep in mind that all you can see is that portion of it that they're posing, that you can't see on top of it or on the bottom of it. You can't see the entire circumference. It's certainly not transparent or translucent or not like a, fortune teller's ball.
Right.
So I say that what you want to do is you want to begin by being interested in, curious about, and asking questions that stay close to what they're telling you, what they're showing you with their story ball at that moment, and that you want to think of yourself as the learner and they're the teacher. And what I have found that as you're curious about another person's story, what they think is important for you to know about them, how they want to tell you their story, that I find that this one-way learning begins to gradually, spontaneously, and naturally shift into a two-way learning, where Lynn Hoffman called it one time when I was talking about this and she was watching my work, she called it contagious curiosity.
Yeah, right.
So it's like the client catches the professional's curiosity and they begin to become curious about their own life, their own situation in some slightly different ways. Often people think of transforming as something that has to look magical or large.
Yes,
almost
right.
Like you can touch it and carry it off. But it's not necessarily that way. And sometimes we don't even realize that we have been transformed by our clients or our clients are transforming until after the fact, meaning until we've had some time to step back and pause and reflect.
Right. Speaking of which, what are the role of questions in your work? How would you characterize that?
Okay. Well, I think questions are a starting point for a conversation, that I have to pose a question to invite someone to speak with me so that I can listen to them and be curious about what it is they're saying, or I like to think what it is that I think I'm hearing that they say. So questions are asked to learn more about that part of a person's story, those narrative fragments that they're telling at any one time. This is in contrast to thinking in terms of pre-structured questions or asking questions to fill out a form,
right,
to collect information, to collect data, that the questions are really informed by the conversation itself, that you don't need to have preformed questions. That's just absolutely not necessary.
Hmm. Yeah, and I think you wrote that questions aren't really a tool for a search for facts or details, but kind of more of an orientation.
Yeah, more of an orientation. They're a way of participating in the conversation.
Okay.
You know, the way that I think of it is you're always responding to the person that you're speaking with by making comments, by asking questions, by your gestures, with your hands, your eyes, your head, et cetera. So again, it's important that the questions, like any response that we offer, maintain coherence with the client and move within the language that they're presenting, not the language that we're trying to teach them. In other words, it's more learning the client's language rather than the client learning our professional language.
Right, and I think that kind of moves us right into your concept of relational expertise, that the client is the expert on their own life, world, problem, and the problem solution, and that as practitioners, we're kind of supposed to be experts at creating space for this kind of collaborative relationship or conversation.
Right, right. And I'm glad that you get both sides of the coin, so to speak, because when Harry Gulish and I first started writing about the client as the expert, we had a lot of pushback on that.
Really?
Because people thought that we were saying we didn't have any expertise or any knowledge, or that we were faking it, or that we were in denial. And we never said that. I would never say that, because I think I do have some expertise. But as you just mentioned, Chris, it's more on the process of the engagement with the client and the conversation and the relationship, not expertise on the client's life. So what we were trying to do in saying the client is the expert was to emphasize that the client is the expert on his or her life. And this connects back to this whole notion of generalizations, that when you think you're the expert, it's very easy to generalize.
Very much, right.
Yeah. So I think of it as myself more as a expert on a process rather than an expert on the content of the therapy or the story or stories being told.
Sure. I want to go back to something you also mentioned, this idea of conversations being mutually transforming.
Mm-hmm.
And I think in some contexts that might be questioned, I would say, that actually clients are influencing us. Because sometimes when that happens, I think it gets maybe pathologized in a way or you know.
Possibly.
Yeah, possibly some ways. Like we're not being good therapists if we're being affected by our clients in some way. Mm-hmm. But can you say a little bit about that? Because I really appreciate that idea of this mutual transformation that happens.
Well, if you think of the kind of therapy process that I'm talking about as a withness process, in there doing together with, mutually inquiring with, sharing in the inquiry, then there's a lot of uncertainty. And what's happening is that you're walking alongside your client rather than sort of leading them from in front or kind of nudging them or pushing them from behind. And when you're walking alongside someone, you're mutually determining the direction you're going, the paths you may decide to wander down or take, and where you hope you will end up and where you end up. And if you're mutually determining that, then all members of that process, all members of that conversation are what I've called in my writing at risk for change. Mm-hmm. It connects with all of these assumptions in postmodernism around transformation. And I tend to use the word transforming or transformation rather than change, because change, if you think in terms of challenging psychotherapy discourses, in some psychotherapy discourses historically, change has been thought of in terms of a client or a patient can change from this to that.
Right.
The therapist has been called an agent of change, mm-hmm. much like the instructive interaction concept. And so really, I just don't think that way, and that's not the way that I experience therapy.
Yeah. I also want to bring up another one of your practices, which is one of my favorites, actually. This has been very influential. And this is this idea of being public. Mm-hmm. And I've experimented with that now for a few years, and it's worked out really nicely. And I was wondering if you could say more about how that came to be and how you think about that now. And
sure. Well, it was originally influenced many years ago when I spent many years also having conversations with clients, mine, my colleagues, clients that I met around the world doing consultations about their experiences of successful and unsuccessful therapy. Mm. And how would they describe therapists that they wouldn't mind seeing again, might even like to see them again? And how would they describe therapists that they would not like to see again? And I learned a lot from clients, which has strongly influenced the way that I think about my work and fits with postmodern ideas. And one of the things that I often heard people say in one way or another is that they really never knew much about their therapist. They didn't know what their therapist thought. They thought their therapist might be having some private thoughts about them or putting some things in their notes that were secret. Or if a student therapist tell it, you know, what were they telling their supervisor? And it just began to dawn on me, why do we have to have these private conversations as therapists? Why can't we share what's going on in our head? So that was one thing. Then the other came from training, where, as you know, in family therapy training and training programs that use teams, it's not unusual to have a team behind a one-way mirror or watch on video.
Right.
And you have a team discussion before the client comes. You have a team discussion at a break. You have a team discussion afterwards. And so in our training early on, we were doing this, which we then changed dramatically. But early on, we were doing this, of course, for several years. And so in the after conversations, we would have questions like, well, what do you really think is going on in this family? Don't you think the mother is this? What about this? And so my colleague, Harry Galish, and I would just kind of look at each other and then look back at the learners on the team and say, do you know, really, if you want to know this or if you have this idea, why don't you, if it's still important next time, write it. You think it's going to be important next time we meet the family. Try to remember it, make a note about it, and start the session with, you know, after you left, we were having a conversation, and here's some things we talked about and wondered about. Hmm. And just ask them, they're the important people. Don't ask us what we think. That's not important. And this was also why we never used hypothesizing, which was very popular in the family therapy field and still is to a large extent.
It is, yes.
And can be very effective. However, what we found is that a risk of hypothesizing is that, as the Milan team warned, you can marry your hypothesis. And so that begins then to give you the ears and eyes with which and through which to see and hear, which then, of course, leads to generalizations, et cetera, some of the things I was talking about earlier. So we would say to our students, you know, if you're working from a hypothesis, what you want to do is really kind of let go of that and find out what the family members' hypotheses are. Those are the important hypotheses. What's guiding their thinking and their actions? So I'm kind of, as you see, you ask me one thing, Chris, and then, and then there are just so many things that my mind shifts to or wanders to.
Well, that's great.
There's so much to say.
But you had me actually shifting, and I was wondering, you had me thinking of Tom Anderson and maybe how he influenced your work and with reflecting teams and that kind of thing.
We were very, very good friends with Tom Anderson, and we first met him, either the late 70s, I guess maybe the late 70s or early 80s, at a WMFT conference. And just really began to be colleagues then, and then first invited Harry Galishanton our way, and then invited the two of us to come. And there was just a camaraderie there, a sharing of challenging, a sharing of irreverence, and a similarity in the way that we were thinking about our work, although we had different language. And certainly this idea of the reflecting team or the reflecting process, which we began to call it, and Tom later, before his death, began to call it a reflecting process, I think was a huge contribution to the field of psychotherapy in general and family therapy in particular, and really connected with our idea of being public.
Yeah.
And one of the things that we would do is, as our work became more known, we would have people from various places in the world come and spend some days with us. And at that time, when we first began doing that, having those kind of international visitors, they would be behind the mirror. And so then afterwards, they would wonder this, or we would take a break and check in with them, and they would wonder this, or... And so we began inviting them to come in the room. Why don't you just come in the room and sit in the room with us? That way you can experience the emotional field, F-I-E-L-D. And that we're totally open that if you have a comment or a question, please join in. So we began having people not reflecting in the way that Tom did, but just really joining in the therapy and adding a different voice. And then later, influenced by Tom and his team's work, began asking them at the end of a session to formally offer some reflections. So Tom's work was very influential. I think the chapter that he has in the book that Diane Gerhardt and I co-edited is really very, very nice chapter. He talks about walking alongside the client. He was very much a witness practitioner in many, many ways.
That's nice. I have another question.
I
have me thinking about, I know you are probably grouped in with what I have heard or written about as characterized as the third wave, this postmodern practice coming on, like narrative and collaborative language and solution focused. I guess I'm wondering how much kind of influence did you associate with Michael White at all, or Steve DeShazer and Insoo Kim Berg? And were you all kind of, did you know what was going on at the time when you were all kind of doing these practices? Or?
We were familiar with their work more so by reading their publications, by attending their plenaries, et cetera, at conferences. We never had a working relationship with Steve and Insoo, nor with Michael, although Michael was in Galveston at a TMFT conference, and he and I did a presentation together the last day of that conference, which was unfortunately just a couple of days before he died. So all of the people you mentioned are just tremendously creative people with a lot of contributions, and certainly a loss for all of us. But aware of their work, but we always thought there were distinctions.
Yes.
And they each respectively often questioned our work, as some others did, sometimes calling it do-nothing therapy and some other pejorative things.
Yes, interesting, okay. So I know now, or my understanding is, recently you've been moving or translating a lot of these ideas into organizational settings.
And I'm
wondering how, you know, because I come from the organizational world in some ways, and I think of this idea of consensus building and all this stuff that you're not really interested in.
Right.
So I'm wondering, how this is, you know, how you do it, or how does this look like, or how are you thinking about it these days?
Well, I carry the same assumptions into the business and the organization world that I use in my therapy or teaching practice. I don't tend to use the more professional language. I tend to use more an everyday language of business. I have found that using reflecting processes in businesses is just really, really valuable. And I have a colleague in China who uses reflecting processes in a couple of companies with the top leadership echelon. And what he does, he will invite five or six people to, you know, be on a leadership team. And each time that they meet, every other week, one person is in what I call sort of the spotlight. And they present something they've been thinking about, a dilemma, a challenge, a decision, et cetera, or just something they want some feedback on. And the others listen and are silent, hold their questions, hold their comments. And then at some point, the conversation pauses. The others offer their ideas. And then my colleague, Haibo Zing, leads a discussion around those ideas and the conversation. And he has found, as I have found, that business leaders really like this because they tend to be in isolation and really don't spend time talking about things that are important to them in kind of a real in-depth way. They're always just really sort of quick, on the go, quick decision, someone's waiting on me.
Right.
And so it creates kind of a luxury space and process for them. I do some coaching with leaders, and again, I operate and perform or live in the coaching arena the same way that I live in the therapy arena, with the same assumptions. Go ahead.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that. I do know you do training and kind of moving from counselor to coach. And what are the differences there for you, or how is it just kind of a different title, but it's kind of the same practices, or does it look something differently?
I would say the process is remarkably similar. I think the context and the agenda are different.
Interesting. Yeah.
Yeah, the context is usually a business or business-related context. I'm talking about business coaching, not life coaching.
Yep, right.
So that's the context. The agenda usually has to do with something either very specific to the person's company or organization, or their quote-unquote role in it, although sometimes it can be an initial request, which is very general, like, I want to improve my leadership style. Well, of course, that requires a lot of talking to find out what someone means, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So I see it as the agenda and the context are different. And the ethics are slightly different because you're working more within a business code of ethics than a psychotherapeutic or psychotherapy professional organization or licensing board rule of ethics.
Right.
So, for example, it's not unusual to be at a same social and have a conversation with one of your business clients, or to have your coaching session over lunch or over coffee at Starbucks or something like that.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
It can be less formal relationship is one way of thinking about it.
Yeah.
A less bounded relationship.
Right. And you're pretty excited about that kind of work these days, or?
I am. And I think that a therapist and counselors can make really, really good coaches.
Yes.
And often I think they can do sometimes a better job than coaches. Yikes, like maybe I shouldn't be saying this, but who come out of the organizational world. Well, let me say why I say this. Yeah. Or let's say they do the job differently.
Sure.
That would be a better way of saying it.
Sure.
Because they have a lot of experiences in relationships.
Right.
And even though I don't like the word skills, they have a lot of relationship skills. They know about relationships. And I would say probably 80% of the people that I work with in organizations and businesses, some component of their struggle or what they may call their problem has to do in one way or another with a relationship or a group of relationships.
Agreed, yeah.
Yeah.
And I think there's just such an opportunity for therapists in that context. And
mm-hmm.
Yeah. So thank you for that. One, you know, in closing and final question, I guess I wanted to kind of just ask you, you know, what else might be capturing your attention or what is exciting you about the field? Or do you have some thoughts or any ideas where we might be headed?
Well, I think in terms of postmodernism, I find that more and more people are getting interested in those assumptions, regardless of what they might be named in any particular country or practice context.
Yeah.
So I find that energizing.
Yeah, you're all around the world, right? So you're seeing more and more people kind of picking up these ideas. Or
it's amazing. And yeah. I mentioned China earlier. In the Asian countries, it's absolutely amazing. I just had a conversation last night with someone in Tokyo, a business executive who's very interested in these ideas in coaching and the notion of dialogue and coaching. It's just amazing.
That's great.
So that said, I'm also interested in how to help people have more access to these ideas and the work. That is through publishing, through doing workshops. So I try to nurture people that I meet or mentor them as I move around the world.
That's great.
Yeah. You know, suggest, why don't you write something about that? Or why don't you start a blog and just share some of your ideas? Like the young man, Haibo Zing, that I mentioned in China, he has a blog that is extremely active. I think he probably gets hundreds of hits every day. It's amazing. Yeah. Of course, there are a lot of people in China on the internet. And I'm interested in ways in which people can come together and meet each other and learn more. So I formed with some of my colleagues the International Certificate Program in Collaborative Practices. We now have 17 programs around the world.
Wow.
And the International Journal of Collaborative Practices, which is a bilingual journal. Hopefully issue 6 will be out within the next 3 weeks. So it's a fairly new journal. Slow moving, 1 issue a year. But again, we have we provide an opportunity for people who haven't published before to publish. We try to help them, coach them in their writing, as well as we have people who have published extensively contribute.
That's great.
To the journal.
Yeah. Just for our listeners, where will you mm-hmm. be teaching or speaking next? Or do you have anything upcoming that they can kind of seek out? Or?
Well, the upcoming things that I have are outside of the United States. I have China and Peru. I just got back from Mexico. I have another trip to Mexico. So they're outside of the United States. In Houston, there is a International Certificate Collaborative Program at the Houston Galveston Institute, and their next session meets in early April, I believe. And then these collaborative practice programs that I mentioned around the world have various meeting dates.
And workshops.
Yeah. So I try to post on my website where I am going, my travel schedule for the year, although I haven't done that this year. I'm way behind.
And there are great resources on there. That's HarleenAnderson.com, correct?
Yeah, .org, HarleenAnderson.org.
Okay.
Although I think you can do .com or anything and my name will come up.
Okay,
but,
yeah.
But the website's HarleenAnderson.org. The journal is the International Journal of Collaborative Practices, and it's collaborative-practices.com/ is the journal.
Great.
And you would think I'd know the webpage name of the certificate program, but if you type in International Certificate Collaborative Practices, it should come up.
And as always, I'll link these in our show notes so our listeners can access them pretty
easily. That would be great. Yeah. And I certainly want to, now that I know about your podcast and what you're doing, Chris, I certainly want to link you and your activities to my webpage. I have that on my list of things to do when I next talk with my web person.
Wonderful. Already. Please do. And once again, Harleen, I really appreciate you taking the time. And hopefully down the road, I'll be able to get you back on and we can talk some more. That would be really exciting.
That would be great, and particularly if listeners happen to have questions or comments, maybe collect those, and I can come back and reflect on their questions and comments or offer something in additional.
That would be great. I really appreciate it. Well, that's our show. Thanks again, as always, for listening in. I'm just really excited to be able to have this conversation with Harleen. Very exciting for me. All these conversations, I get nervous before them, but this one I was particularly a bit nervous because I just, you're talking to a legend. So yeah, you want to do a good job. And so I just think the conversation went really well, and I want to thank you for listening in. So having said that, please, as always, send us some feedback at theradicaltherapist@gmail.com. We love to hear from you. I still have stickers available. If you'd like some stickers, I'd send them out to you. If you could do us a favor, please go to iTunes and rate and review the show. This is very helpful for us to get out in front of people, and we would appreciate that. And also, we're on social media on Instagram at The Radical Therapist. We're on Twitter at The Rad Therapist. And we're on Facebook. Go find our Facebook page at The Radical Therapist and like our Facebook page. We can keep you up to date that way. So, as always, this is Chris Hoff, and this has been The Radical Therapist. Thank you.